This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
We still believe that the election was not free and fair. We still believe that the election was manipulated. There are a number of things that we can do.
That's Douglas Mwanzora, an official with Zimbabwe's opposition, talking about today's court ruling on the election. Details coming up. Also, the United Nations reports that Ebola has spread to a town in North Kivu in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Zimbabwe's top court has confirmed the results of last month's presidential election, clearing the way for Emmerson Mnangagwa to be inaugurated president. The ruling rejects the opposition's MDC Alliance's challenge to the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission's decision that Mnangagwa won with 50.8% of the vote. Reporter Kuza Zanawashi is in Harare reporting. Patrick Chinamasa is the ZANU PF Secretary of Finance.
We are very happy that the Constitutional Court has upheld the free will of the Zimbabwean people, which was expressed on 30th of July 2018 when they voted. And this is despite the attacks, after attacks, the barrage of attacks that were launched against ZEC itself and the chairperson of ZEC and the electoral system. There was also a barrage of attacks lodged against the Constitutional Court itself.
The Constitutional Court judges ruled the MDC failed to prove convincingly there was widespread voter fraud. 23 candidates ran, but the top contenders were the ruling ZANU-PF party's Mnangagwa and the MDC Alliance's Nelson Chamisa. Douglas Mwanzora is the Secretary General for the MDCT, one of the opposition parties. He says his party doesn't agree with the ruling and the election should have been annulled.
We still believe that the election was not free and fair. We still believe that the election was manipulated. There are a number of things that we can do, but I do not want to preempt the National Executive Council of the MDC, which is meeting next Wednesday to decide the way forward. But there are a number of options.
J. Peter Pham, Vice President of the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C., says all sides need to move calmly.
But are the people appointed figures who can reconcile, who can bridge gaps, or are they going to be hardliners who exacerbate the divisions within society? Probably it's incumbent on everyone to act responsibly. The government needs to restrain security forces from overreacting. It's their responsibility to do so. The opposition also needs to be responsible. Getting people incited to provoke a reaction is not the way to vindicate their objection.
Mnangagwa has served as president since November when the army ousted Robert Mugabe, who had led the country for 37 years. The move came after Mugabe fired Mnangagwa as vice president and took actions that would have placed his wife in a position to succeed him as president. While the vote was considered to be one of the most peaceful and relatively free in Zimbabwe's history, at least six people died when security forces cracked down on protesters a few days after the July 30th vote. There are fears that angry opposition supporters may in the coming days again take to the streets. The United Nations reports that Ebola has spread to a town in North Kivu in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The patient is a doctor living in Ocha Town, an area surrounded by an Islamic militia group, the Allied Democratic Forces. Initial tests for the doctor were negative, but his wife, who traveled to the nearby town of Beni, is infected, and he is being tested again after falling ill. Nearly 100 of his contacts have been identified. World Health Organization officials say insecurity is making it hard to access affected areas. The militia surrounding Ocha town are holding aid workers, government officials, and priests. Earlier in the week, UN peacekeepers escorted health workers to Ocha. So far, the epidemic has infected at least 103, including 63 deaths in North Kivu and Ituri provinces. The outbreak, which began on August 1st, is the 10th to hit the Congo since 1976. The South African government today apologized to white farmers for poor communication about its possible expropriation of their land to speed up agricultural reform and to put more farmland in black hands. The apology comes at the start of a nationwide public consultation process on land reform. 24 years after the end of apartheid, the vast bulk of the country's commercial farmland is owned by whites, who make up only about 8% of the population. Director General of Agriculture Mike Molengana today said the proposed constitutional amendment to allow for land expropriation without payment has been misinterpreted as the beginning of a state assault on white farmers. Darren Taylor explains.
A gathering of white and black farmers in Limpopo province has highlighted the many land reform projects that are being driven by white farmers. Some have already given their land to black people and are mentoring them to become fully fledged commercial food producers. Mlengana says it's a pity that the African National Congress government has up until now been ignorant of most of these white-driven initiatives. He revealed that Minister of Agriculture Senzeni Zokwana has chastised state officials for not allaying white farmers' fears that their land is about to be taken.
And the minister stands up. You government officials are talking to us DGs. Why have you not gone out and speak to the farmers? There is no thing like that. Where does it come from that we are coming with gun blazings to take white commercial land?
Mlengana also says a list circulating identifying 139 white-owned farms to be taken by the government has been misinterpreted. He says the 139 white landowners are simply asking the government to pay too much for their land, so the state will ask a court to determine a fair price for the farms. Mlengana emphasized that white farmers have a future in South Africa.
Those who are going overseas and doing all that, they are destroying the future of this country. You are killing this country. The day your friends up there kill this country, they are killing the economy of this country. Where are you going to live? Even if you go overseas and say, I'm running to Australia, I'm running, they will distrust you. Because wherever there is a debate, your first interest, not the national interest, matter more.
The Director General says the future of agriculture in South Africa is white and black farmers working together, funded by government.
At this point, you have been using your money. At this point, you have been trying to get there. There is money available that I'm trying to channel towards that partnership.
In the midst of allegations of widespread corruption within the land reform process, Mlengana said the Department of Agriculture is committed to better administration and has to manage taxpayer funds much better. White farmers at the gathering have cried as they've pledged to correct the wrongs of the country's apartheid past. As one put it, our fathers stole the land, and if we are given the chance, we will hand it back, but only to skilled black farmers who are dedicated to producing food for the country. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Bela Bela, South Africa.
Uganda's former head of police, Kali Kaikura, appeared in a military court today. He was charged with arming a criminal gang and for allowing refugees to be abducted by the police. Among those allegedly kidnapped was Joel Mutabazi, a former bodyguard of Rwandan President Paul Kagame. Mutabazi was taken from a UN refugee camp in 2013 and returned to Rwanda. Kaihura was appointed police chief 13 years ago. President Yoweri Museveni fired him in March. Kayihura fought alongside Museveni and helped bring him to power. His case has been adjourned until September 4th. The hearing comes a day after five members of parliament, including Robert Chagulani, a pop singer known as Bobby Wine, appeared in court for treason charges. They were arrested last week after a protest blocked Museveni's motorcade during campaigning for a by-election. The past 2 weeks has seen a number of developments in the Uganda political scene, starting with the stoning of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's convoy. As mentioned above, five opposition legislators, including Robert Chagulani, better known as pop star Bobby Wine, now face treason charges. His arrest has set off protests by his supporters both at home and abroad. J. Peter Pham, vice president of the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C., says the conflict in Uganda represents the start of a generational change. He spoke with VOA's Paul Alexander.
The thing that is different in this case, there are two things primarily. First, it's the role that the military has played in this, in the fact that the court-martial actually released Bobby Wine, and then he has been rearrested by civilian authorities. So it shows there's a little bit of daylight between the government and the military. The second thing is the nature of the opponent under fire. For many years, of course, the leader of the opposition was Kizza Besigye, who is of the same generation as President Museveni. This time around, you know, the opposition leader in question, Bobby Wine, is someone who is of an entirely different generation. He was barely a toddler when Museveni came to office in the 1980s. So he's part of that generation that makes up three-quarters of Ugandans, those who are young people.
So do you see this as a sign of a growing clout for youths, and that maybe Museveni has misplayed this a little bit so far?
I think time will tell if he's the incumbent president has misplayed this strategically. But demographically, it's quite clear that time is not on his side. The issue in question, of course, was the lifting of the age limit that the Ugandan constitution has for running for the presidency. There was an age limit that no one over the age of 75 could run. That would have meant that President Museveni, who's currently 73, would be ineligible to run in the next election, 2021. That was lifted despite opposition by Bobby Wine and other parliamentarians. As I said, three-quarters of Ugandans are under the age of 30. That means a majority of the population were not even born when Museveni first took power. So they don't remember what came before him, and all they have is what they have in front of them. And I think that's going to be a major factor, if not in the next election, most certainly in the ones coming up.
And what do you see as the main challenges that Uganda has to tackle to tamp down some of this disenfranchisement?
Certainly economic opportunity. Young people are facing, as we do everywhere, the quest for jobs, for meaning in life, the ability to start families, all of which are economic questions profoundly. So to build an economy that is growing in step with the growing population, that's one. Two, the young people are much more connected today because of technology, and they are better informed about what's going on in their own country and in neighboring countries, and they're seeing winds of change in neighboring countries. Look at what's happening in Ethiopia and other places. So, and they're looking at a leadership that has not changed. It's not that Museveni has not delivered, and certainly an improvement over Milton Obote and Idi Amin before him, but after 32 years in office, people are going to wonder if it's not time for a change, especially young people who've known nothing else. This may be the signaling of a passing of the baton.
That was J. Peter Pham, Vice President of the Atlantic Council, speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander. 19 past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. 5 years ago, General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, then Egypt's defense minister, asked the Egyptian people for a popular mandate to fight terrorism. Early this year, the general, now Egypt's president, launched Operation Sinai 2018, promising to eradicate terrorism in 3 months. The Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy in Washington reports that the number of attacks has gone down. However, the institute says the country's counter-terrorism strategy failed to prevent radicalization or to achieve long-term stability. David DeRoche is an associate professor at the National Defense University in Washington. He spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about the shortcomings of the Egyptian counter-terrorism plan.
It's clear that the Sinai is not more stable now than it was years ago, and the situation, if anything, is deteriorating. It's become an issue where, you know, it's not just of concern to Egypt, but also of concern to Israel. And the problem, as I see it, is just that there seems to be a lack of imagination and adaptiveness by the Egyptian security forces. If that were to occur, then perhaps they'll be able to deal with this. It should be noted that the southern Sinai has been relatively calm, and that seems to be because the Egyptian security forces have engaged in a political dialogue with the tribes there alongside their security measures, and that's been able to attain a measure of peace. So hopefully they can migrate that model north.
North Sinai Agriculture Directorate reported that 90% of the farms in North Sinai's main cities have been entirely razed during the military operations that negatively affected every sector of the Sinai population. How could such loss affect radicalization in the region?
Farming is really rough because it requires stability. You know, you have to have stability of water supplies, stability of weather. You have to have the ability to protect your land while the crop is growing. You have to have stability of labor market while you harvest it, and then you have to have stability to get it to the market. And obviously, when you've got an active insurgency going on here, that impinges upon stability in a big way. So even aside from battle damage, just the economic damage done to agriculture is pretty severe. And that's to be expected. So, you know, to the extent that it employs people and a lot of the work is seasonal, so that fits in with the Bedouins, the deterioration of agriculture in the northern Sinai is also going to have a bad effect on the economic situation, which will further feed the insurgency.
Tamer Rafai, the military spokesperson, described the campaign in Sinai as the most comprehensive operation, which will continue until it achieves its goals. What's your take on that?
I think it will continue. I think that the Egyptians are very determined. I'm not sure if it will achieve its goal anytime soon or at a cost that Egypt and the people who live in the Sinai will regard as acceptable. The Egyptian counterinsurgency strategy appears from the outside to be primarily an iron fist, and there doesn't seem to be the associated glove. There doesn't seem to be the carrot, only the stick. So it may be possible for them to bomb their way out of this, but it's going to take a long time, and there won't be anything left to fight over when they're done.
You served in Sinai before. What kind of changes or modifications should the Egyptian government introduce to its counterterrorism strategy to achieve its goals?
Sinai is one of the most beautiful places in the world, and I was very lucky to have served there. But terrorism and insurgency is inherently a political issue with a military facet. And if you just have a military response, then all you're doing is dealing with the symptom of what really is a political problem. So there has to be, if you want to solve it, you have to have a political reaction. And that political reaction needs to come from the government, and it can't really come from the Army. The Army has had, and the Ministry of the Interior have shown that they're just not capable of doing with this. So, you know, what you have to have is something like a super governor who can direct security forces, but can also, more importantly, direct reconstruction and some sort of economic assistance, establish markets, build in incentives for people who are wavering. You know, the hardcore of insurgents, they won't be reconciled. They have to be killed or captured. But there's a large number of waverers who may support the government, may support the insurgents. And there has to be something attractive in the Egyptian government to get them to support the government. That's the real challenge.
That was David LaRoche at the National Defense University speaking to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawy. Ethiopia and Eritrea normalized relations last month after 20 years in a state of war, but the two countries are believed to still have thousands of troops stationed along their shared border. Analysts say the way the leaders handle this sensitive topic will be a barometer for future relations. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Ethiopia and Eritrea have taken major steps toward peace in the past month, resuming flights, reopening telephone links, and allowing families to meet after more than 20 years of separation. But the Horn of Africa neighbors still have issues on the security front, especially in regards to the troops stationed along their 1,000-kilometer-long shared border. In July, Eritrean media say troops have withdrawn from the border, but that has yet to be independently confirmed. Political expert Awol Alo says the issue can be resolved if the two governments can muster enough political will.
Well, as two countries that were on a war footing for the last, as I said, 20 years, it is one of the most complex security problems you can imagine. But at the same time, it is really a security problem that can easily be resolved in the sense that once the underlying political disagreements and political problems are addressed, the security problems are not that complicated.
Between 1998 and 2000, Ethiopia and Eritrea fought a war over disputed territory on the border that claimed an estimated 70,000 lives. Since the war, the East African neighbors have accused each other of supporting rebel movements and opposition groups in each other's territory. But in June, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said his government was ready to respect a 2002 Boundaries Commission ruling that gave the disputed town of Badame to Eritrea. Meresa Desu, a senior researcher with Institute of Security Studies, says the countries are still wary of each other.
So we
cannot say by now the army are in demilitarized area. The military is still there. It is a cautious relation among them. Alo says the strength of newfound peace will be judged by how the countries can manage their border issues.
Security, as I said, is the primary. Demilitarizing the border is one of the key, for example, measure by which people can judge that the two countries are moving forward. So Eritrea withdrawing its forces, Ethiopia withdrawing its forces from the border area, and the border becoming kind of a normal border that doesn't necessarily feature such a huge movement of armed forces.
Before the border war, Eritrea fought a long war for independence from Ethiopia, which it achieved in 1993. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehigis Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News, coming up 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.